The fourth lecture in the Spring Colloquium Series will be delivered by Dr. John Wheatley, who is Professor of Philosophy and Dean of Graduate Studies here at SFU. He has a BA from McGill, an MA from UBC, and a PhD from the University of London. He has taught at Queen's University and the University of California before coming to SFU, and has taught widely at universities in Canada, the US, and the UK. He's the author of two books, as well as many articles in journals of philosophy and mathematics. His field of inquiry is contemporary analytic philosophy, with emphasis on the philosophy of language. John and I had a bit of a mix-up on our written communication regarding his verbal communication. He indicated his title would be Verbal Communication, and he would talk about the transmission of knowledge and the communication of culture, and has informed me since that this may not serve the key elements in his address, but he must touch on them given his written communication. John, please feel free to verbally communicate on verbal communication.
Thank you kindly. I have a list of apologies which I'll go through very quickly. First apology underlined, which I wrote just before I left the office, having left a meeting early in order that I could put something together for you, is underlined, deans have no time. And of course you make a commitment some months in advance, and then the day comes and you've done very little about it. Apology number two is essentially, as Bill announced, I'm going to talk on verbal communication. I gave as a reason in the thing I wrote to him that it was worth talking about, because of course it is the way we transmit our culture. It is the way indeed we build up a science. But that's the justification for worrying about verbal communication, or one of the justifications. It is not what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about it very little, though it will interfuse from time to time. Apology three. I know of lots of other ways to communicate other than verbal communication. I sometimes get the suspicion in this department that people rather ignore verbal communication, and in more than one sense, that is, between each other, and also as a means of communication, but I wish to concentrate on it, the verbal communication, meaning communication via language. I had originally thought I might talk to this group in the sense of read a paper that I wrote a long time ago, which was entitled A New Mode of Communication, The Riot. And this was I wrote it back in the days, when I was deeply bound up with the riots at the University of California, and I was deeply impressed with their ability to communicate. It was at the time when there had just been Watts riots in Los Angeles, and then the campuses blew up. And it was astonishing what people had been saying, verbal communication, for years, got put across with a few stones and a few gunshots, and in the case of the campus that I was on, $1 million worth of damage and somebody dead and that sort of stuff. Remarkable. But I decided the paper was badly dated and I hadn't got the time to update it, so you didn't get the paper on communication via riots. My fourth apology. Some of you will know what I'm going to say. I'm not in this department. I don't know what's covered in courses in this department. I know the disciplines and the interests of many of the faculty in the room. I know the disciplines and interests of few of the students. And as a consequence, I may put out to you Coles to Newcastle, a way of communicating, please note. That is just too damn bad, because there's no way I can get round it. And finally, my fifth apology. This will be a discursive paper. I'm going to touch on quite a number of different things, and in the discussion, and I don't propose to talk too long, I'll take up any one of these things. But I want to try and give you, among other things, a range of the notion of verbal communication. It has indeed been tied far too closely to statement making. And I'm going to come back to the limitations of statement making as a way to communicate. Indeed, I want to virtually push it to one side. The reason statement making, of course, has been overemphasized in the whole question of language and verbal communications is the baleful influence of my own discipline, namely philosophy. And philosophers for a long time really thought that statements were the only way you communicated. That was the end of that. Well, today, of course, we know you communicate with your body language. We know that the tones of voice, the attitudes with which you speak, and so on, all these things are important to communication. But still, this asphyxiation with statements, I think, even infects your discipline. It certainly infects mine. So I'm going to have something to say about statements, and it's going to be mainly negative. Now, first of all, I want to put out with a few facts. And these are facts that many of you will know, and some of you may wish to dispute. The reason you may wish to dispute them is that I'm going to give numbers, and you may want to say the numbers aren't quite right. All I want to say about the numbers is they're the right order of magnitude, whether they're the right number or not. So, all right, you all talk. You all talk English. Some of you may talk other languages. But there's some facts about the way you talk. For instance, that your written vocabulary is of the order of 1,800 words. Even as university students, it's not much higher. For a taxi cab driver, it tends to be 1,200 to 1,400 words. But you, the elite, the sophisticate of the society, for you, 1,800 words. In the spoken language, it goes up to about 2,400 words. That's in part that there are certain things that you'd say that you'd never write, both for legal reasons and for reasons of politesse. It's also because you command, in fact, a larger vocabulary in speaking terms than in terms of writing. And I'm not talking about a lack of spelling skills, which may also exist. In terms of reading, however, you command a vocabulary of about 10,000 words. And one reason the professors are very hard to understand is often with them, their written and their spoken vocabulary come very much closer together. They tend to use a much wider vocabulary than do ordinary people. But even in terms of a read language, probably your upper limit is about 10,000 words. Now, if you were a doctor or a lawyer, that is, one who's graduated, you would have added another 5,000 to 10,000 words to your vocabulary. In some sense, jokingly, you can say that learning medicine and learning law is learning a new vocabulary, an extra vocabulary. Now, of course, if you're talking in terms of a surgeon, that's a bit gross, because his vocabulary doesn't matter, it's his manual dexterity. People ask, you know, where have the craftsmen gone when they look at the lousy furniture we all have to live with? And the answer is very easy. They've gone to a much higher paying profession, namely dentistry and surgery, where the same manual skills are used. But for the doctor who sits there pushing pills, which is what most doctors do, what he has acquired is a very much larger vocabulary. Now, that not only includes, of course, knowing the words in the sense of being able to pronounce them, it involves knowing when he should use those words, like appendicitis, for instance. A doctor commands the word appendicitis in the way that most of you do not, and even more something like amitriptyline or something like that. But you can make a joke, and it is a joke, by saying a doctor, a GP, really just goes to medical school to learn the vocabulary. He knows all about the fibula and the tibula, and all those things which in the main you don't know about, but in a very large part he has learned to identify things that you can't identify. He's learned a vocabulary. And I don't want to overemphasize the joke, because it is a joke, but on the other hand, I don't want to underrate it. A huge part of learning, and being a lawyer and a doctor is only striking examples of this, is to learn to command, to use correctly, a very much wider vocabulary. Now, when one starts talking about vocabulary, when one starts talking about people talking and the meaning of what they say and the import of what they say and the communicative value of what they say, there is a huge myth abroad. There are many myths abroad, and I will take on in discussion all sorts of them, such things as words stand for things, or words stand for ideas, or nonsense like that. But that's not one I'm going to discuss. I'm only going to discuss one right now. And the one I'm going to discuss is to do with the notion of definition. Many people have the idea that the way you get at the meaning of a word is to get its definition. They find it difficult to define the words that they use, but nevertheless, they really think that definitions is the way to do it. And I'm first going to give you a formal argument to show that that's impossible, and secondly, I'm going to give you a completely empirical illustration that it isn't the case. Now, the formal argument is quite simple. Take a dictionary of the English language. It can be quite a small dictionary. It would be preferable for the sake of work that you do that it would be a small dictionary. And you go through and you look in that dictionary for every word that is defined. And every time you find a word that is defined, you cross it out of the dictionary. Now, of course, it's going to be defined in other words, so that when you come across these other words, you've got to be careful that they are defined in other terms than the word you've already crossed out. That is, you're taking the vocabulary of English, and by crossing words out, you're making it smaller. Right? And I don't care how many words you cross out. Now, at the end of your crossing out process, you're still going to have a dictionary. Clearly, you can't cross out the last word, because when words are defined in terms of words, and you're not allowed to use the ones you've crossed out, there'll be absolutely no words that could follow that final word, such that you had a verbal definition of it. So it's quite clear in this formal sense that if you took English and you tried to verbally define every word in it, you could not do it. It could not be done. A crossing out process by which you eliminated definable words. And you know, there are lots of them. The guy who prevaricates puts things off. We all know that. So you can cross out prevaricate. There's no worry about that. The word father-in-law can be crossed out, because a father-in-law is the father, is the husband of your wife's mother. But you have trouble crossing out wife. So, here's a formal argument. You could go through a process of crossing out in a dictionary, and you'd end up still with a dictionary where no word was verbally definable, except in terms of the words you crossed out, which by definition isn't fair. And this is a completely formal argument and completely sound, that you could not verbally define every word in the English language. Now, I imagine that that is no strange proposition to people in a communications department, because I imagine that insofar as verbal definition is discussed in this department, and indeed in terms in which verbal communication is discussed in this department, the emphasis is not on verbal definition. Nevertheless, in fact, in talking to some of you, because some of you have come to see me about problems of one type or another, I think you still hang on to this myth. You say things to me like, well, that's all a matter of definition. And of course, when we're talking about senior supervisor, it is. Senior supervisor is defined in regulations as a guy with certain responsibilities and certain duties. But with many of the things you say, well, that's just semantics, or that's just a matter of verbal definition, the answer is you're wrong. And I'm now going to read you a little bit that I wrote a long time ago about dictionaries and verbal definitions. It's not very long, and it has the merit that at least it's reasonably carefully worked out rather than straight off the cuff. In this, which was a much longer thing that I was writing, I was asking a question, and the question was, what's the difference between a justification and an excuse? Okay? Now, I don't know whether you find that easy to understand. I gave a group of examples, and I'll read you to them quickly. Supposing somebody is accused, his accusation is possibly important here, of having been drunk the night before. What are his possible responses? And here I have just a group of responses. I don't pretend they're all the possible ones. One could say, Jones put brandy into my glass of milk, and I didn't notice. One could say, yesterday was the Sabbath, and my religion calls for the celebration of the Sabbath with the consumption of large quantities of spirituous liquids. You could say, I was celebrating, or I got promoted today. You could say, I wasn't drunk at all. I was just happy and excited. You could say, sure, so what? These are responses we might give. Now, pursuing the question of justification and excuse, and trying to see the sorts of ways we might sort them out, I come finally to the postulation, well, hell, look the two up in the dictionary, and then, of course, you'll know. And this is where we come to dictionaries. And here's what I wrote about dictionaries. The standard response in this sort of situation is to say that dictionaries provide definitions such as we need. People who say this do not spend much time looking in dictionaries. I might add, I am a dictionary man. I like them, I'm interested in them, I collect them. In the first place, dictionaries very often do not define words, and when they do, the definitions are frequently unexplicative, they don't explain it at all. Not unusually, the definitions are wrong. For instance, here is the relevant entry from the Oxford English Dictionary for justification. You might listen to this carefully. Quote, exact quotation from the OED. The action of justifying or showing something to be just, right, proper. Vindicating oneself or another, exculpation. How often do you guys use the word exculpation? Incidentally. And yet justification? Unexpected. Okay. The first thing to notice about this entry is that we appear to be offered three definitions, not just one, and that these definitions do not look as if they are equivalent. Let's think about them a moment. More important, the first of these definitions is unexplicative, and the other two are wrong. Let us start with the last one, just because it's wrong. A justification, we are told, is an exculpation. To exculpate oneself or another is, of course, to get oneself or the other person off blame. It is true that if one has done something and one successfully offers a justification for doing that thing, then no one can blame one for doing that thing. In that sense, you're taken off blame. But that is not the same as saying that the meaning of the word justification is exculpation. Not at all. Before one can get oneself off blame, one must have first been blamed or accused by somebody. But to give a successful justification for doing something, one does not have to be blamed for doing it first. Similarly, there are a number of ways of getting oneself off blame for doing something, and not all of them are justifications for doing that thing. In the most obvious instance, a successful excuse gets one off blame. So it just does not define the word justification correctly to say that it is an exculpation, even though it is true that a successful justification exculpates. Exactly the same objections apply to saying that a justification is a vindication. So the second and third definitions offered in the quotation that I gave you are just plain wrong. And I would like to emphasize that fact. Most dictionaries have many, many mistakes. And if you care about dictionaries, I would suggest to you that the OED, the example I took here, has the fewest mistakes of any dictionary because it's been revised so often, but it is also prescriptive. It says there are lousy uses of this word, which I happen to be current, which are wrong and shouldn't be used, but here's the right one, and that's what makes it a bad dictionary. But in terms of accuracy and granting that one sort of side phenomena, it's a good dictionary. The new Webster's Dictionary, on the other hand, took into account modern theory of linguistics, which says essentially the meaning of a word is really the way it is used. It's a reportive activity. It tells you how it is used. And as a consequence of that, of course, it is a very different dictionary from the OED. However, the number of mistakes that it makes is very, very much larger. Reasonably enough, they're trying something new. Okay, the first definition, which is in some sense the most interesting, that justification means, quote, the action of justifying or showing something to be just, right, proper, end of quote, is notably unexplicative. We are concerned about what it is to give a justification, and we are told, for instance, that it consists in showing that an act is just. All we get out of this is some information as to how the root just takes morphological variation. Nothing much about the notion of justification. So we still appear to be, as far as we ever were, from solving the question of what justification means. I'll take up dictionaries again at the end if you want to. That's not anymore. I want to make an historical observation, one that you're acquainted with, and I think probably in this department especially acquainted with, because it's in some measure emphasized. We have had a peculiar transition over the last 200 years between what's primary in talk and what is not primary. 200 years ago, the primary thing in talk was talk, something people spoke, something you did with your lips. And that was because there wasn't a high rate of literacy, and in the second place, there was not mass media. There wasn't radio, there wasn't television. This changed. This changed partly because of the vast increase in literacy and partly because of the increase of the media. And the media, though they appear to be the spoken word, 99%, of course, are not the spoken word. Interview programs, and we all know how bad they are, do tend to be based on the spoken word, though even then there's prompt cards, you know. But the plays that you see, the plays that you used to hear over the radio, the news broadcasts, all these are based on the written word. It's read out loud, all right. But you are not listening to somebody talk. What you are listening to is somebody read or recite. And when you read or recite, what you do is you base what's being said on the written word. And this has had a number of interesting cultural events, and I don't want to go into all of them. One of them, of course, is it's brought the common man closer to the learned man. As I'm sure you all know, in the Middle Ages, for instance, the language as written, which tended to be Latin, was a highly formalized language, a very limited language, in many ways a highly unexpressive language, and as a consequence, the written word at that time was a very unexpressive thing, and it had living beside it the spoken word, which was the real living word, which was spoken by everybody, and you got this tremendous divergence between the spoken and the written word, which was a class divergence in large part between the high class, in the case of Europe, the priest, in the case of China, the mandarin, who wrote the language, and on the other hand, the vernacular, which is what people spoke. And these were miles and miles apart. And it took, I think, the mass media and the spread of literacy to bring them back together again. Now there is no mandarin in this country. There are civil servants who write a language understood only by civil servants, but that's because they read each other's minds. That's not because they write the English language in a different way than anybody else. They just write it very badly. But there is no mandarin in the sense that there was in China, no mandarin in the sense that there was the priesthood who had the lingua franca of Latin, and that was the way they communicated one with the other. And I may say, from the point of view of communication, I think that this bringing together again of the spoken and the written word is tremendously important, and I think that we have a far richer language, both a far richer spoken language and a far richer written language as a consequence of this. Now, these are discursive remarks about the language that we all handle in some sense. Some of us better than others, but nevertheless, we all handle. Now I want to come back to a moment.
Excuse me. Yeah. Richer, but not more complex.
Oh, more complex as well.
No, but I mean, are everyday languages any more complex than, say, it was 200 years ago?
I would have thought that it was, and I would have thought it was because of the infusion of the academic tradition. But the problem of the academic was the written language tradition, and yet the written language tradition has also gained enormously from the infusion of the vernacular. I would thought.
Yeah, linguistics say, well, I don't know, I read an article not too long ago that said that it doesn't matter what culture you're talking about, language is complex, and it's equally complex, no matter which culture you talk about.
Well, I hate to speak from authority, but I, who've written a book in linguistics about the analysis of different languages on the computer, can assure you that that's false. It really is, honest, even if you read it in an article. It's just like dictionaries. Don't believe everything you read. We'll come back to it later.
There's
I want to make...
There's a problem here, John, which is, I think, sort of hidden, because you keep saying language, and you're really talking about discourse. There's a difference between language and discourse. What your examples come from... The discourse that we speak is also historically conditioned in various ways, which is not the same as the English language per se. It's a subset of the English language. And I think that subset has changed quite considerably over the centuries for all kinds of reasons.
Well, it's the origin of the English language.
The language has become more complex per se. It always had that complexity as part of its deep structure, as a possibility within it.
Oh, sure. I mean, if you're talking about...
That's what
the deep structure, in a Chomskyan sense of the deep structure of language, that deep structure has not changed except in very peripheral ways.
But I think that's what the problem is about the use of the word complex.
I see.
Because we're talking about different parts of the same language.
If indeed we're talking about deep structure, I would have thought that deep structure hasn't a history in the sense that if it ever was simpler, we don't know about it.
Probably, I think that's the case.
Let me go on a bit. Statements. I want to put down philosophy. Philosophers really have been asphyxiated with statements. They really think it was the only method of communication for a long time. When they wrote about language, they only wrote about statements. And it's been a relatively new phenomenon, one that began in one sense in 1931, but in a very obscure way, that is, with one man talking to a very small group of students in Cambridge, and began in a very public way in 1946 with a paper by a man called Austin called Other Minds. And I want to move away from statements and not very much discuss statements, because I think they've been over-discussed. And if you're really interested in statements, I can give you bibliographies that are as long as your arm to read about statements. What is interesting is things which aren't statements. And what's interesting is indeed even the function of statements has been grossly misrepresented by people who wrote about statements. And I'm talking about people as old as the Port-Royal logicians, quite as much as I'm talking about people like Russell and Whitehead and Frager and stuff like that. And that is the function of the language. And I'm now talking about something different, agreed here. The function of the language and the function of statements is very often to tell lies, to cover up. One of the huge functions of language is to deceive. To suppose that the main function of language is to communicate, or any way to communicate what's true, is to grossly misrepresent the historical development of language. And you can all think of examples. It's much, much easier to say to some appropriate lady or some appropriate man, "I love you," than it is to behave in a lover-like way. To behave in a lover-like way is a long, complex, very subtle thing. To say "I love you" is simple as hell. The language provides us with a method of hiding, of miscommunicating, of deceiving. And this function of language has been grossly ignored by the philosophical tradition, and I may say by the grammatical tradition as well.
Not by the novelists.
Yes. But I wonder whether the novelists in general have. I'll buy your standard. I'm not quite sure I'll buy your novelists. First of all, I'm going to produce one or two illustrations. And the illustrations are going to start off statementally and they're going to move away from statements. Think of the statement, "Jones is at home." Now, we normally think that a statement is either true or false. There's quite a lot of statements that aren't true or false, some of them interestingly and some of them uninterestingly. Uninteresting ones fall into this category. A Victorian poet, for instance, wrote the line, "A woman is a foreign land." Now, this clearly is not in any serious sense true or false. It might be taken as an incitement for exploration. It might be taken as a statement that you can never understand a bitches anyway. There's lots of different ways you could take the statement. Indeed. but we all know about that. The poets have some liberty, the novelists have some liberty. They have produced things that look like statements which don't really have the normal statemental properties, true or false being the most obvious. But there are other ones. Take "Jones is at home." Supposing you're in the situation that you're visiting Jones, and Jones, doubtless because he drank too much over dinner, has a heart attack and dies. A friend knocks at the door. Is Jones at home? Well, you know, you moved him upstairs and put him on the bed, but he's dead. Is he at home? Isn't he at home? Is it true that he's at home? Is it false that he's at home? The only thing I want to illustrate here is this. There's the tendency to think that a statement must be true or false, and yet there are all sorts of ways in which our assessment of statements is oblique to true or false. If somebody asks you, "Is Jones home?" when he's dead upstairs in bed, the correct answer is something like, "Well, he's dead upstairs in bed." The correct answer certainly isn't either yes or no. Either of these would be an important deception. So another worry about statements is if you make the wrong statement and you're supposed to answer yes or no, or you just think of statements as being true or false, and somebody makes the wrong sort of statement, then indeed you don't know what to do. One of my quarrels with the late president was he used to ask me regularly when we met, except we didn't after a while meet very regularly. He used to say to me, Wheatley, what's the correct percentage of graduate students for any given university? And I would say, that statement has no answer. Then he would say, well, what is the correct proportion of graduate students for Simon Fraser University? And I would say, that statement only has what I call a consequential answer. That is, I could work out the correct number of graduate students for Simon Fraser as a number, and then I could do a little arithmetic and find out what percentage that number was of the undergraduate population or the total population, and give him an answer. But he didn't want that answer. He wanted an answer which said, in general, 10% of the undergraduate student body, or 20%, or something like that. I never succeeded in convincing him that his question, and questions after all statements interlock, that the statement that he wanted me to make couldn't be anything but a foolish statement, and therefore one I wouldn't make. And because he was caught up with his true-false syndrome, the notion that there must be a true statement that accurately reflects the facts, it just threw him that that might be the wrong thing to do. And I offer to you about statements those two things. You can ask the wrong statement, in which case its association with true-false is a poor association, or alternatively, you can seek a statement where no statement is appropriate, or not that sort of statement is appropriate. But now let's move away from statements where there's any temptation to call them statements. Consider sentences in grammatical form which look like statements, they're typically in the present indicative, and yet state nothing. And I'm not playing tricks on you, I'm not thinking of statements with words like all or ought or something like that in them. I'm thinking of really quite straightforward statements that appear to say of some subject that something is true, and yet they don't. And many of you have either made such a non-statement in your life or proposed to make such a non-statement in your life. And I'm thinking of the statement as part of the marriage ceremony, I do. And when you say I do at the appropriate moment in a marriage ceremony, you are not making a statement. You are not describing a marriage which is going on as if you, so to speak, were God and remarking that these two people were getting married. You would be undertaking a marriage. You would be indulging in a marriage. You could not later say, I made a false statement. By saying, I do, you got yourself married up, whether you liked it or not. Now, that's only half true. Whether you liked it or not has limitations. If your companion at the altar was a goat, then under the laws of this land, you would not be married at the end of it. And there have been historical examples of some amusement. Francis Assisi, you may remember, was upset because the dumb animals were all condemned, if not to hell, at least to... What the devil's the other place that isn't hell? Purgatory. Because they weren't christened. So he started christening them. And part of the christening ceremony, I assume, I don't know, I was never christened, and if I had been, I wouldn't remember, but it must be something like, I christen you John Henry, or whatever, right? Now, what happens when somebody goes through this sort of thing with something which isn't the right thing to do it with, as trying to marry a goat? And if you try and christen a penguin, because a penguin hasn't got a soul, see, so how can you save it?
John, they used to put animals on trial for crimes at that same period, too. So well, there's some connection with some kind of legal order as well.
Precisely, but... Well, I don't think so, because though they thought they were guilty of sins, they didn't think they had souls, and I'm not going to go into the theology of why this was. Now, there's a whole class of utterances which look like statements. I do take you to be my duly wedded wife looks like a statement, and it isn't. I promise to meet you in the library tomorrow. It's not a statement. You're not right. It isn't true or false. You are not reporting on a promise. You are making a promise. I bet you a dime that such and such will happen is not to report or give a statement true or false about a bet. What it is indeed is to indulge in a bet. It is to start betting. continue through. Now, I finally want to move on to an area which is particularly popular right now, and popular in its disrepute. And one of the things I want to convince you of is it shouldn't be in quite the disrepute that it's in. Sometimes when I make statements in my office, people say to me, well, that's an evaluation. And I usually say, sure. Or they say, that's an evaluative statement. And I usually say, sure. But by saying, that's an evaluative statement, they somehow want to say it's not worth having. Well, skipping the question of true and false, and I don't for a moment want to take up the question of true or false with evaluation, what I want to do is suggest to you that evaluation is something that we do all the time, that we do verbally all the time, though we can do it unverbally as well. We all know of that sort of evaluation, but I'm not talking about that one right now. I'm talking of verbal evaluations. And I've even taken the trouble to classify them a little bit for you of the sorts of ways. And in particular, I'm interested in those sorts of evaluations that don't involve what I call philosophical worry words. Philosophical worry words are words like good and bad and beautiful and so on that philosophers through the ages have worried about. What is the beautiful? What is the good? What is the suum bonum? You know, words, phrases, concepts, I don't care what you call them, which have been done to death and which I think students of communication very rightly ignore. I think it's a long tradition which it's a good idea for you to sit down and busily ignore. But communication is your business, and evaluation is part of communication, and it therefore is also your business. Now I'm going to read out here rather quickly some various classifications of evaluations that I've made, and I've in fact got them mimeographed, and I'm not going to distract you while I'm talking by giving them out, because then everyone would read them rather than listening to them, but I'll give some out during the discussion if you want to pick up any one of them. I divide them into semi-evaluatives and evaluatives, and the difference between semi-evaluatives and evaluatives is that semi-evaluatives really needn't make evaluations at all, it's just that they can, whereas evaluatives tend to make evaluations, though they don't always have to. Again, I don't have to tell students of communication that context can be vital in these instances, and that therefore to take just quotations in abstract can bias the situation. But that's the difference between them. First of all, we can evaluate. Let me give you, I've got some examples here. So I'll read you first. Sorry, I forgot the examples. Here's the classification. I would have liked to have given you the examples first and classified them up. Exclamations. These are things that you can do, or these are things that you can say in certain circumstances which evaluate. For instance, standing before a picture that you're being asked about, you can say, ouch, or you can say, wonderful, or a good many more things that are completely unprintable. Or you can just simply make a statement of fact. Notice that. These things do not divide. These things interlock. One can say, I like it, or I can say, it makes me feel sick, which may or may not be true, but is an evaluative, almost certainly, whether or not it's true. Gerundives, and I'm not going to give you an explanation of why I use the word gerundives. It derives from the work of a man called Ziff, who I strongly suggest you don't read. It's sublime, it's desirable, it's awful. Then three, evaluation using literal falsity or exaggerations. Now don't underrate the value of saying something which is known to be false. When I was taught logic 20 years ago, 25 years ago at McGill, I was offered the purest nonsense in justification for various sorts of logical relations. For instance, if that's true, then I'm a Dutchman. And this was used to justify certain sorts of ways of talking. But of course, to show that you think that whatever is under discussion is false, to say if that's true, I'm a Dutchman, is only useful if you're obviously not a Dutchman. If, on the other hand, you say, if that's false, I have 3 warts on my backside, which I show to nobody but my girlfriend, then indeed it doesn't have the same function in utterance. But right, here's a set like that. You say of something which is undoubtedly a man, male, all the rest of it, you say he's not a man, he's a mouse. One says of some perfectly ordinary female, or even one that's rather extraordinary perhaps, she's an angel. You say of all sorts of things, preferably somebody else's child, I would imagine, it's a monster. Or you can say of a fairly ordinary human being, he's 10 feet tall. You can do it by actually stating facts, things that are in the ordinary sense true or false. You can say he's a liar and a thief. You can say she's a swinger. You can say he's a fool. You can use simile. You can say, let us go back to a modernistic piece of art. You can say it looks like a fugitive from a junkyard. Or you can say of some dish placed in front of you, it tastes like potted donkey. And you should notice the last one works perfectly. You know perfectly well what I think of a dish placed in front of me if I say it tastes like potted donkey, whether or not you have ever eaten donkey, potted or not. And then there's a final one, I don't know how to sum them up. I call them near simile. You can say she has all the grace of a runaway tank. You can say she has the voice of a nightingale. Here's a few examples of the sorts of ways that we do evaluate every day, and notice, as part of the vernacular, and notice not using the good, the beautiful, and all the other words and concepts that have been done to death. And I would suggest to you that if really good work is going to be done in the notion of evaluation in the future, it's going to be done in the Department of Communications, it's not going to be done in the Department of Philosophy. Departments of philosophy have got so hung up on very, very standard ways to give very, very standard sorts of evaluation that though they may or may not make some sort of an advance in ethical theory, they are not going to do anything about evaluations. Now, I'm coming very close to the time that I set myself as the time that I would talk. So I'm just going to give you another set of sorts of talk which have a different sort of interest. And their different sort of interest is that they fail to communicate and yet they look as if they should communicate. And I would suggest to you that those of you interested in verbal communication, that the subject of how we fail to communicate is as interesting as the subject of how we succeed. I think this is probably a truism in the area that Tom Mallinson deals with, for instance, so it's small group interaction, and where the failures are the most important, and where indeed you analyze possible future success out of current failure. So failure is an enormously important study, I think, within the whole field of communication and the field of verbal communication. In other writings, I have called these things things which fall into the category of the logically opaque. And just to do your soul good, I'm going to give you a little bit of history of philosophy so you can see how one of these things arose, and then I'll go on to give you some more examples. Descartes, a 17th century philosopher, often called the first modern philosopher, usually claimed as the origin of every current movement in philosophy. He's the origin of existentialism, if nobody's told you that, or if they've told you that, I'm sure they haven't told you that he is the origin.
He was a consequence, sure.
Well,
you will
equally be told that he is the beginning of modern analytic philosophy. I'm certain that you will be told that he is the origin of modern psychoanalytic thought, and he quite certainly is the origin of the discipline in mathematics that we now call analysis. Anyway, his greatest discovery, for which he is the most famous, was, as you all know, proving his own existence. And his argument was very simple, like this. He said, I'm going to try and doubt everything I can doubt. I doubt that what I see is there, I doubt that what I feel is there, I doubt the things that I have been told by my forefathers and by my teachers, I doubt everything I conceivably can. But, said he, sitting there doubting, how can I doubt that there's a doubt box? In other words, there's no doubts without a doubt box. And Descartes happened to be, in this particular occasion, the doubt box, all right? And so with a flourish of trumpets, he said, therefore I know, therefore I can prove that I exist. Summed up in a phrase that you all know, I'm sure, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, though it should have been I doubt, therefore I am, that being the basis of his argument.
Now, the greatest confidence trick in philosophy.
You can call it that too, if you want. Now, what Descartes, in fact, discovered is that there are some sentences, he only discovered one, but that's because he was unimaginative, that there are some sentences it makes no sense to utter, meaning that you've got a complete breakdown or failure of communication, all right? And the sentence he discovered that it makes no sense to utter is the sentence, I don't exist, all right? It'd be pretty silly of me to sit here and say to you, I don't exist. And that's the sense in which Descartes proved his own existence. He proved, or you don't have to prove it, he gave an illustration of a sentence it makes no sense to utter. And I'll give you a few more. To say I know that S, where S is some statement, all right, I know the earth is round, I know that S, but I don't believe it, makes no sense. It's not a contradiction. Contradictions make no sense either, but I'm being more sophisticated with you than contradictions. To say I know that S, but I don't believe it, or even S, but I don't believe it, itself, you know, it's wheels turning in the air. Words have been spoken. One thinks communication should have taken place, but it has failed to take place. And here's a few more examples, quite as important as Descartes in their own way. Consider, I'm not speaking. Or consider, I am asleep, or even better, I'm dead. Or consider, of a very different type, I promised to do X, I promised to meet you in the library this evening, but I have no intention whatever of doing so. Or consider the statement, a very famous one, goes back before Christ, I am now lying. What do you make out of that? Or even, John has no children, and every last one of them is bald, which some logicians have wanted to call true. Okay, I've been highly discursive with you. I've talked a little bit about the language as it really is, numbers of words, words you command. I've talked a little bit about dictionaries and how they are not the source book in language, which a great many people would like to think of them as being. I've spoken a bit about the interchange between the spoken word and the written word, and I have received some challenge on the degree to which their new coming together is in fact an enrichment of both. I have done something to do down statements, and I do hope that insofar as any of you are interested in verbal communication, you remember what I have said about doing down statements. The asphyxiation with statements through the centuries has, I think, been one of the most baleful influences on the study of language. I have talked a little bit about other forms of communication than statement making. I've talked about ways in which you say things which don't, and here's, if you like, the technical definition, which don't describe something, I make a statement, they do something, like signing your name at the bottom of a document, or saying I do in a marriage ceremony. Talked a little bit about evaluations, and I've shown you that they don't differ, kapunk, from statements, and that they are, incidentally, things for which we can often give reasons. They are not, in the favorite phrase of today, quote, always or entirely subjective. There's nothing subjective about saying of a man that he is an idiot when he is. We know ways to test for things like that. And I finally talked a little bit about ways in which verbal communication doesn't work, where we have words and everything looks right grammatically and the individual words are understood, but nevertheless the utterance as a whole fails to come off as a piece of communication. And I recommended to those of you interested in verbal communication the study of when verbal communication doesn't come off, not for the psychological reasons. He couldn't bear to hear such terrible things about himself, but in the simple sense that It doesn't come off in that it could come off to nobody. It's not a worry between A and B. It's a worry that words, language, is being used in a highly inappropriate way, though the grammar books wouldn't have noticed that it was a highly inappropriate way. And that's it.